This is Myrna Kaiser. The title of the course is Responses in the Darkness. This is the third session. Suffering in the New Testament. The concept of suffering lies right at the heart of the origin of Christianity. Thinking of New Testament Christianity without the existence of suffering would be like envisioning a car without an engine or Holden without buttons. And while the major problem facing the Old Testament writers is the justice of suffering, we look at the New Testament and find that in the life and the teaching of Jesus, there's absolutely no discussion on why suffering should exist. There's the handout sheet. Welcome. You don't hear Jesus saying, why is there suffering? So I think we're going to have a different light on our theme today. We have a lot to do, so I guess I'd like to invite you to take a look at how Jesus responds to suffering. In the first section that I have, a number of verses, we will not look at all the verses, but focus on some of the key ones, and you can reflect on the others in your own study. Jesus does not theologize or philosophize, but meets the fact of suffering in a direct and practical way. And I think my favorite passage is Mark 1, 40 to 41. So if we could turn to Mark 1, 40 to 41. And would someone read this?
And a leper came to him, beseeching him and falling on his knees before him, and saying to him, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And moved with compassion, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I am willing, be cleansed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how does Jesus respond to the suffering of the leper here? What's his response? Compassion and action. He sees the suffering and then he does something about it. I think I guess I've mentioned this over and over again, you're probably getting tired of hearing it, but we live in a society where we're kind of trained to just shut it off. Even we hear things on the TV and on the newspaper, and we hear it night after night, and we just have learned to condition to just shut it off. And even in our daily experiences, coping mechanism, we have learned to shut off and not see the hurt, not see the suffering.
Except for I am involved.
Good point.
Your eyes are closed. If okay. You don't know, except for yourself.
Uh huh. That's an excellent point. We see and immediately are so sensitive to where we're hurting, the eye. But when it comes to others, but yet, I guess I want to qualify that. Go ahead.
I could say, unless you know, if the hurricane is where your children are they okay?
Uh huh. Yeah.
That kind of
right.
You know. Something that relates to yourself.
That's the
not
I.
Not always you personally, but yeah. You know, your own personal body, but.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to say, because we're trying to get to the hour.
Yeah.
Of I.
Uh-huh.
We still haven't gotten to the hour.
Yes. I like this illustration here, and so I'm going to read it. Nature has seen that we're out in nature and so forth. Nature has provided that animals who live in the areas of intense heat or cold. Boy, I'm having problems today. evolve protection against their environment. The lizard in the desert is protected from the heat of the sun with a tough skin. The polar bear is kept warm by its immense coat of fur. In us humans, nature seems to protect us against the sight of suffering by having us grow numb to it all. And that may be a useful defense in some ways, but it is a protection the Christian is called upon to shed. And so following, if we are struggling in our sessions together on how we should respond, if we follow the example of Jesus, we will not be unmoved. We are called to respond like Jesus, to recognize the suffering, the hurt, shed our protective hard shells, and respond in action. I want to also make a point here too that the leper, according to Jewish law in the first century, was considered unclean and untouchable. And the leper was an outcast, and no one was supposed to touch a leper. They were to separate themselves from the leper. But Jesus is so moved with pity and compassion, he ignores the social taboo. He went against Jewish tradition, and he went against the establishment of the day, and he stretched out his hand and touched the leper. So he not only sees the hurt, he not only moves to action, but he even goes beyond that and goes against society. And I think a lot of us are, you know, we're really concerned about going against society, worried about what others will say about us. Jesus' love was so strong, his compassion was so strong, that he disregarded the social taboo. And so, go ahead.
I would say, it also brings out, you know, I can give $10 to the hurricane, mm-hmm. but for me to go down and touch the one that's hurt, you know, that, and that's what Jesus did.
Yes.
You know, I have compassion, but to get that personal touching involvement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think you can see why I just think this is such an exciting and such a super illustration of suffering and how we're called to suffer. I think it says so much. I'll tell a story about my brother-in-law. Bob's brother was living in Alaska in a very remote village, and at the outskirts of that village lived a prostitute. And of course everyone in the village knew what she did, and when she would come to town they would ignore her. They'd actually go on the other side of the street to avoid her. And it was reported one day that she was very ill and even to the point of death, but no one would go and help her. And the pastor of that town did go, and you can imagine how upset the villagers were. And I should put a footnote that my brother-in-law really is not a very religious person. And this story, he said, if anything was to convert him, this story in this illustration of compassion would have converted him. And the pastor every day would go down to her cabin. He'd cut wood for her, he'd fix her meals, and he finally nursed her back to health. And I think this is a contemporary example of what it means to have compassion, that we would be willing to go against society. And that happens in today. You know, we can shut our eyes to the fact that maybe things like that don't happen, but hey, it happens, especially in issues of gay, the problems of gays, and problems with prostitutes. There are people in our society who are in the situation of the leper. And so, would anyone like to respond before I continue on? Alaska, in the northern village in Alaska, he was working there. So, one other verse that I would like to take a look at in regard to Jesus' response. He does not theologize. Oh, how we love to theologize. but it meets the fact of suffering in direct and practical way. John 9, verses 1 through 11. And if someone would please read that.
And he passed by and saw a man blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, he was not that this man sinned, or his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. We must work the works of him who sent me, while it is day. Night comes when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. As he said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and anointed the man's eyes with clay, saying to him, go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back, seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar said, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He said, I am the man. They said to him, then how were your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight.
Okay, thank you. Okay, what happens here?
Looking for retribution.
Okay, we're going back to the Old Testament. And how does Jesus respond? He completely ignores it, doesn't he? He kind of refutes the idea that suffering was a result of sin. And yet we today, we respond, what have I done to deserve this? And I think I think we need to be reminded that there's a difference between the retribution idea, contrary to the cause and effect. You know, if I drink too much, you know, I have the chances are I'll become an alcoholic. You know, if I am promiscuous sexually, or I'll have the chance of having a venereal disease. You know, there's a difference between cause and effect and the retribution. And also, we can go beyond that, and yet, you know, the righteous will have, you know, cancer. So, Jesus refutes this idea that I think so often that we as Christians take certain verses, and somehow we've memorized these verses, and this is one verse that everybody seems to be familiar with. How does Jesus respond to the suffering of others? We will not look at the verses on this. He suffered vicariously for others. He took the place of another. And Mark 10:45 and John 10, I think, are good scriptural illustrations of this. Okay, let's go beyond. And how did Jesus respond to his own suffering? We have a lot of verses here, and we'll just take a look at a couple. Jesus accepts his suffering, indicated by his prediction. Let us look at Mark 10, verses 32 and 34. And for the tape, I will read the other verses. Mark 8, 31 to 33. Mark 9, 11 through 13, 30 to 32. Mark 14, 17 to 21. Matthew 16, 21 to 23. Matthew 17, 10 through 13, 22 to 23. Matthew 20, 17 through 19. Matthew 26, 20 through 24. Luke 9, 22 and 44, Luke 17, 25, Luke 18, 31 to 33, Luke 22, 14 to 23. So if someone would read Mark 10, 32 to 34, please.
And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them, and they were amazed. and those who followed were fearful. And again he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to the chief priests and the scribes. And they will condemn him to death, and will deliver him up to the Gentiles. And they will mock him, and spit upon him, and scourge him, and kill him, and 3 days later he will rise again.
Okay, my response is that Jesus accepts his suffering, and that's indicated by his prediction. Now, in all of these verses, you know, in Mark 8, Jesus says the Son of Man must suffer, and Peter rebukes that. But the fact that Jesus does predict his suffering indicates that he indeed does accept it.
He talks, too, about suffering and at the same point turning his face towards Jerusalem. He walks toward it. Mm. It doesn't like as though, well, one day it might happen, but mm-hmm. he faces Jerusalem and really see it and embrace it. That's
okay. I like that word. Here he faces directly his own suffering. Yeah, good, thank you. And then he also asks to be delivered. Okay, let's take a look at Mark 14:33-36. Could someone read that, please?
And he took with him Peter and James and John, and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible to thee. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what thou wilt.
Thank you. Any reflections?
Even
okay.
None
good.
Of us like to
suffer. Good. Okay. Jesus had a human attitude towards suffering, and I think.
No, he didn't go complain to anybody else. He went right directly to his father.
Okay, he went right to his father and expressed. Uh-huh. Let's take a look at Luke 22:44. Would someone please read that?
And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground.
Okay, this kind of expresses the agony, the really the real deep struggle that Jesus had with his own suffering, his own death. He didn't want to die. Okay, please feel free to insert, any comments. He asks why God has forsaken him, Mark 15:34. Don't we sometimes feel guilty, saying that to God? This has been a constant theme in our time together, but here's another reinforcement. Jeremiah, asked the question, and now we're coming, hey, Jesus. And so isn't it human, isn't it okay for us to ask, why, God, why does this happen?
But it seems that there's a progression of gradually turning away from the suffering. I mean, he faces Jerusalem, and then, as it gets closer, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, if this cup can be taken away from me, do it, but your will, not mine. Mm-hmm. And then on the cross, he says, why have you forsaken me? Mm-hmm. And each point has a little more hesitation. I mean, at the very beginning, he sets the face to Jerusalem, and he knows the suffering, and this is what must happen. Mm-hmm. And there are three predictions of his suffering that he gives along the way. Mm-hmm. But then when you, by the time you get to the cross, then he says God has forsaken him. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And there seems to be this kind of progression in the story. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it's getting...
It's getting tougher.
It's more real.
Yeah. Maybe that's like we are, you know. Yeah. Sure, I'd be willing to suffer for my faith. Uh-huh. You get a little closer to it. I don't think I was called to this. I think someone else was. Yeah, that's very human too. Yeah.
You know, I can say now, you know, if I ever have a terminal illness or something, you know, I keep telling Bob, boy, don't put me on machines, you know. But, you know, it's easy for me to say that now, but when the day comes, you know, I might treasure every second and every minute. And but thank you. Before we, go on to Paul, do you want to make any further comments on...
You mentioned about not complaining and that we don't do this as Jeremiah and Jesus really did. And don't you think that what we're doing is really bearing this and suffering more the consequences of not really complaining to the Lord and communicating to Him? We're bearing it and having a lot of other problems because of that.
Oh, good point. Good point.
I think that's interesting too, because I found occasionally I let myself slip and I do complain to the Lord. Well, that has been the greatest thing, because it ends up like, I noticed you put Psalm 22 in here, which starts out with those words of Jesus, because even that psalm ends up in praise. Mm-hmm. And once you spew that all out to the Lord, He just takes that all in. Mm-hmm. And then you preach a praise at that point. I just find it releases all of it so wonderfully. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, when I start out in agony and end up in praise, it surprises me a lot that it happens.
But what was the first words you said? Sometimes I let myself slip?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're letting yourself slip, but actually that's the best thing to do. I've seen this recently, they have these new equivocating things out, you can find in 5 or 6 stores. And I was on a person lamenting, oh, why don't you take care of this problem for me? Why are you ignoring me? And ended up with God saying, you never let go of your problem, you kept it to yourself. Mm-hmm. Although you continued your complaining, you never really let go. Just give it to me and let it go. Mm-hmm.
Good.
It seems to me too that there's a matter of being, you know, being honest with God, which is almost seems silly because God knows what's in our hearts. But but you know, to try to pretend that or prettify our prayers, you know, and just choose the special words for our prayers rather than just to be totally honest. Mm-hmm. It seems like that's the only way we should ever pray is in total honesty.
Yeah. Yeah, what a waste of, you know,
pretending.
Yeah. And when I think of the word therapy, you know.
I also think that it does, you know, it might last a while, complaining. Not so, maybe that you're hanging on, but some things are so intense that you don't get over them in the first sign. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
you have to go out.
Are we ready to go on to Paul? Okay, suffering for Paul was the daily experience, and he does not question the existence of suffering. Remember, the people of Israel. They asked, why are we suffering? And their conclusion was because of punishment and progression from punishment of the nation, punishment of individual. And Paul doesn't question, you know, why the existence of suffering, but he asks, why, I love arrogant Paul, why should I, a faithful apostle, have a superabundance of suffering. And so that's where we find Paul. I have here, Paul accepts his suffering and continues to do that for which God commissioned him. And second, Paul perceived suffering from the standpoint of faith and saw that suffering has the potential for good. I have a feeling that, you know, you probably know the story of Paul well enough. So the fact that he accepts his suffering and continues to obey the will of God. He continues to preach after he was stoned, as indicated in Acts 14, 19 to 20. He continues to praise God after he was imprisoned in Acts 16, 22 to 25. Maybe it would be helpful just to read that, Acts 16, 22 to 25. Paul was really convinced about his commission, that he was commissioned from God. Maybe sometimes because of our terrible inferiority complexes and other complexes that we have, you know, we wonder, God, me? You know, we can't accept the fact that God has called each one of us. We can't accept the fact that we're all special, you know, and God's using all of us. And so when others, especially here, Paul defends himself when other people reject him. 2 Corinthians 10 through 12. Paul really knows what he's about, and he doesn't let other people intimidate him. I think we can learn from that. Does anyone would like to make a comment about Paul and his dedication to God before we go on?
Do you have any comments about Paul's remarks about his so-called thorns in the flesh? I can't remember where that is either.
2 Corinthians 12.
12, is it? That's where I was.
Well,
verse 7. Keeping from being too elated by the abundance of revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, for Satan to harass me, to keep me from being too elated. Three times I besought the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said, my grace is sufficient for you, so forth.
Okay, what was the 2 Corinthians?
Yeah, 2 Corinthians 12, 7. Beginning at 7.
Okay, 2 Corinthians 12, beginning at 7, speaking about Paul's thorn. Does anyone have any insight into what Paul's thorn in the flesh? I don't think we really know, but speculation has it, that Paul was short of stature. And that was one thorn. Another thorn was he indeed was suffering some type of physical, you know, problem.
I heard it was his eyesight.
Yes, eyesight too. Uh-huh. So, were you getting at something, Bob?
No, I was just curious if it seemed to me that whatever it is, if indeed it's a physical ailment, here he prays that he can be released from it, must nevertheless deal with it and accept it as best he can. Mm-hmm. So he wrestles with it here, it looks like, mm-hmm. whatever it might have been. Did you read something where he was also a forced public speaker and had to speech like that?
Yeah.
Those are all speculations, but
the shortness and stature doesn't seem to, well, you know, I don't know whether you'd go there. If we were a grown man asking God to take that away,
stretching.
Seems like it would be more something
Something
be removed or changed.
Okay.
But it's interesting, the point that he makes about the thorn, the flesh is, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. And there's a lesson to be learned about his relationship with God. And not that the suffering, I don't know if the suffering, that you could say the suffering was given to Paul by God to teach him that lesson, but at any rate, Paul learned a lesson that was really important for his ministry. And Paul does, you know, have his arrogant side. It may have been a necessary lesson for Paul to learn a little humility at times.
We can think of some people who might profit from that, can't we?
But that's the kind of redemptive side of suffering, it seems to me, that it is, there's not always a loss involved, but there is something.
Okay.
Of course, the difficulty is you try to tell somebody that.
Yeah.
And here again, you can't tell anyone. Yeah. My brother is going through a real hard financial time right now because of the economy, and my mother is worrying a lot about it. And we're talking about, and I said, well, there's probably a lot of good things to learn because their values are really, I mean, way out there. And they might learn some things about it that are more basic. She said, yeah, that's right. And so then she proceeds to go ahead and tell my brother that, well, this will probably be a good lesson about I just hope she didn't tack my name on it. And I said, that's nothing you can tell anyone.
Yeah.
Or when we know when we're hurting and someone tries to console us with some kind of... There comes a point where we can see the good that can come out of that, but...
It does seem to be the sort of thing that you have to learn as you go through it rather than have somebody tell you, as you say.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, a lot of people are losing their jobs because of the steel. And I have a friend who's a counselor, and the amazing thing that he's finding is that these people hated their work, but that was their security and how traumatic it was when they lost their job. But now, after going through a struggle for a time, they're changing directions and they're doing things they always wanted to do. They're changing, you know, 40, 50-year-old people are going to vocational school, you know, and it's just unbelievable what is happening. But of course, not everybody reacts that way.
I can relate very well to that. That verse means so much to me. Because 2.5 years ago, I had that stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And my eyes were taken to tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I never appreciated my eyes, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got this Bible. The children gave it to me.
Mm-hmm.
It means so much to me. I can read the little print now. But it's so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought at the time I was going to be left like that. But now my God is so blessed. One eye is 20/30 and the other is 20/20.
Mm-hmm.
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 Mm-hmm. And something is taken from me. I appreciate it all along.
Yeah. It's too bad, isn't it, that that has to happen?
Well, you just take it for granted.
Yeah.
My eyesight was always quite good.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think a way to help people through their suffering is not to directly tell them that this is eventually going to be good for you, you know.
Right.
But as you see a strength building up, like my roommate's gone through a lot of things recently, and you can point out things to her that where she's gained strength in dealing with certain situations, or where she's matured in an area. And then I think if you help point that out to someone, they can start to see how the suffering has helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I remember a time in my life when people responded that way to me, you know, you're going to be such a strong, much stronger person. I was angry. I angry at them, angry at their religion and everything, you know. And
I think we have to.
Well, I'll tell somebody it could be worse. And it's not for tea.
It's more starving Armenians.
I got three busy little boys, and I can remember when Gail came. Boy, God really wanted to bless you. Mm-hmm. They're all going, shit, I didn't need that at all.
Well, let's get on to Paul, because I think the next section, Paul perceived suffering from the standpoint of faith and saw that suffering has a potential for good, ties in with what we've been saying, and also will evoke a lot of discussion. For the tape's sake, let me read what we have here, and then we'll take a look at some of the verses. According to 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 to 7, Paul's attitude was that the more suffering, the more comfort. Romans 5, 3, suffering produces endurance. And 2 Corinthians 4, 17, suffering prepares us for eternal life. Okay, let's first turn to 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 7, a real paradox. And of course, all of Paul is a paradox, I guess. Second Corinthians 1, 3 to 7. Would someone please read that?
Message is on. Even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercy, and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. And whether we be afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effective in the enduring of the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or whether we be comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation. And as far as you want me to read?
Mm-hmm. Any reactions to what Paul has to say here?
Paul says also, I think in 2 Corinthians, later on, the suffering that he's going through produces life. So death is at work in us, but life in you. Again, the idea of the suffering that brings life for others or comfort.
Yeah, for us, I think we think of suffering and comfort and life and death as opposite opposing forces. I think for Paul, that's not so. Notice in 2 Corinthians 1, 3 to 7, there's the constant repetition of the word comfort. And so we have a paradox here of comfort and suffering. And I think we have a hard time understanding paradoxes and accepting paradoxes.
You know, the thing that's interesting is at this point how Bob, things we've mentioned in the Revelation class, the suffering of the martyrs, and Dr. Yoder's class about the law of Christ, to be able to embrace suffering, to break the pattern and the course of evil, because ultimately that is life-giving rather than to resist evil with evil.
Mm.
And at that point, it seems here all those things come together.
Yes.
Is this a kind of more specific kind of suffering that's done for the sake of Christ rather than just suffering in general, would you say? Or would you say this is any kind of suffering?
Oh, I would say that, you know, and someone can correct me because I would say that for Paul, everything was under the standpoint of faith. All his suffering was standpoint, and you have the suffering, affliction, and so forth, so that in order that it is for. So for Paul, I think it's for the faith, but
his life seems to be so totally embraced by God's will and purpose working through his life, you know, that even the suffering of the shipwreck, you know, I mean, it's one thing to be stoned, you know, at the, because of what you're preaching, but another one, I mean, it's just a bad storm on the sea, and yet he sees even the suffering there as connected to.
Yeah. One concern I have, well, whenever we study any text, and I hate to pull verses out like this, is that it was written for the time. Okay, Paul really believed in the parousia. Paul really believed that the end of time was coming. And I believe that's the reason that Paul was, you know, so wrapped up in proclaiming Christ and Christ crucified. You know, I wonder if Paul were alive today, if he would be so fanatic, you know. And so I think we have to keep that in mind, that one reason Paul was such a fanatic was that he really believed, hey, that Christ is coming. You know?
Time is short.
Yep, time is short.
I wonder how the Good News Bible translates the word that is in RSV as comfort, and mm-hmm. and in the King James as consolation, I think.
The Good News is help.
Help. Oh.
Can you read a line?
Yeah. Well, if we suffer, it is for your help and salvation. If we are helped, then you too are helped and given the strength to endure with patience the same suffering that we also endure. Is verse 6.
Well, how's verse 7 do?
So our hope in you is never shaken. We know that just as you share in our sufferings, you also share in the help we receive. And that, when I first looked at the end of that, that reminded me of what outreach groups do, divorce outreach, or various sorts of groups like that, that those who have been through that particular sort of suffering are examples and helps to others going through that. Mm-hmm. Widows Counseling mm-hmm. Services.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I've thought that before, that when you have been through something, you feel differently in helping somebody else if you've been through it. Whereas up in verse 4 it says that we may be able to comfort or help, whatever, those who are in any affliction with the same comfort.
Well,
which is saying something a little bit different.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good point.
But you do, I think you go about it differently, you know, if you've been through it.
That's a good point.
Maybe in a way it's like getting from my suffering to our suffering, also being able to take our specific suffering and generalize that.
Yeah.
To feel for anyone in any sort of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Good.
There is a kind of commonness about suffering, isn't there? Even though we've emphasized its uniqueness to our individual lives, but one, you know, obvious illustration of that is how counselors today are speaking of the experience of divorce as comparable to the experience of bereavement when you lose a spouse or a friend. And in divorce, it goes through some of the same kind of stages. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. good. Yeah, this word comfort is really important, and I think it's the idea of complete deliverance. I think we think of comfort as a feeling, on a feeling level. And for Paul here, it's complete deliverance. Thank you for complete deliverance, not only, you know, for self, but for others, as you stated. Good. Should we, let's see what time we have. Well, let's look at Romans 5:3. Just quickly, suffering produces endurance.
More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character.
You want to say, oh, come on, Paul.
Yeah, so on that verse, let's remember that after the fact, we probably can say that, but we do not want to.
Well, I suppose if we were the one who were screaming, if we read that ourselves, if someone else was telling us that,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be sort of hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 2 Corinthians 4:17, suffering prepares us for eternal glory. And remember yesterday I asked you the question, if you did not believe in a life after, would you be a Christian? This is, let's read 2 Corinthians 4:17.
For this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, because we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, and the things that are unseen are eternal.
I think there's a motivation there. I think we're talking about two different sufferings. When Paul talks about rejoicing for his suffering, I think it's that he sees his suffering as being instrumental for the life of the church and what God is ultimately doing in all creation, that how it is contributing to that. And yet, suffering perhaps over the death of a child, that's not an occasion where you rejoice in your suffering because it produces endurance. I think when Paul talks about endurance there, it's kind of like that image in Philippians about the race. And he's realized what it takes to run that race, and that he has this charge given to him. Mm-hmm. But then there's the suffering that comes out of sometimes the capriciousness of life. Mm-hmm. And what sense do you make of it there? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that Paul addresses that kind of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Jesus more so, the man who was blind and
yeah.
so on.
Right.
But doesn't really ask the question of why has it happened and what is the response.
Mm-hmm.
Paul's vision was pretty narrow in terms of who he was and his apostle and what his charge was and what he had to do. And
mm-hmm.
you know, and like you said, because of parousia, he just did it.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything contributed to that. You don't see personal side of Paul. You know, you don't see him visiting with Mary and Martha like you would with Jesus. You know, it's such a dogmatic kind of thing.
Although I'm studying him more this year, we went through all the letters that he wrote. You do see spots of his weeping, his feeling of just complete intense sorrow over, you know, what some of the people were doing and different things going on. So I got a little bit different picture than I had before.
Hmm.
One other thing I, along that line about Paul suffering in the church is in Colossians 1:24, another place he talks about rejoicing and suffering. And if you compare that with the Romans, let's see if we read. He says, now I rejoice in my sufferings for your sake, and in my flesh I complete what is lacking in Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, that is the church, of which I became a minister according to the divine office which was given to me for you, to make the word of God fully known, the mystery hidden for ages and generations, but now made manifest to the saints.
Colossians 1?
1:24.
Okay.
It's an interesting idea. Not that Christ's suffering wasn't complete, but as though there is somehow a suffering that still has to go on for the mission of Christ. I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago. It was clearer in my mind then than it is now. But there seems to be a place here where in the life of the Christian, for the sake of the church and the role of the church in the world, that suffering is part of what happens, but he can at this point rejoice in it because he sees that that is contributing to a greater good of what God is doing in the world. And that he and somehow participates in the same, I don't know if you want to call it the same type of suffering as Christ, but there's a connectedness between the suffering of Christ and now we as part of the body of Christ suffer. It's not real clear, but it's just one more passage that deals with his, with Paul's suffering.
This is good, and I think this is where we will take off for tomorrow. So I think it's a good place to end, but I'd like to end with a little, very little story to tie in with what you're saying. Stanley Jones tells this story. A wealthy farmer prayed in his family circle that his unfortunate neighbors might not starve. When they arose from their knees, his little girl said to him, "Daddy, you needn't have bothered God with that, for you can quite easily keep them from starving." Well, tomorrow we will try to pull everything together, and suffering must go on. Thank you.
Thank you.